Welcome to Positioning 365 Beyond Seating, presented to you by Ultimate Medical, the makers of EasyStand and Zing Standers and Activate Bath Safety Equipment. In this podcast, we discuss topics related to clinical practice, advocacy, research, and end users' experiences and perspectives, related specifically to complex rehab technology beyond the wheelchair. We're going to talk a lot about standing today. So my co-host for this episode is Britta Schwartzhoff, who is a member of our clinical advisory board from the CAB, which is what we call this. She is a physical therapist and a RESNA certified ATP and SMS. My name is Kristen Cizat, and I am the host. I am the clinical education specialist here at Ultimate Medical, and I'm a physical therapist and board-certified neurologic clinical specialist. I'm also a RESNA ATP and SMS by background. Today, though, our guest star that we're so excited to talk with is Dr. Kara Masalink. Dr. Masalink is a PhD, an OT, an ATP, and an HPCS, and is an associate professor at Western Michigan University in the Doctor of Occupational Therapy program. She's an executive director of the Clinician Task Force. Her clinical background is working with a variety of populations in various settings that led her into assistive technology, where Kara found her passion. With a desire to impact equipment access at a greater level, she pursued her PhD in interdisciplinary health sciences, which facilitated current research and publications focused on guiding clinical practice for appropriate equipment provision and ensuring access to complex rehab technology equipment for people with complex medical conditions. Kara has engaged in policy reconsideration projects such as the Medicare coverage of power seat elevation that we all know, and the power standing in collaboration with clinicians and assistive technology industry to inform documents that promote change. Kara is also a MIOTA and part of the AOTA and RESNA member. So I wanted to welcome both Britta and Kara. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen.
All right. So specifically what we're going to be digging into as we talk with Kara is we're going to discuss a recent publication that she was a part of, and this is called the RESNA and CTF Position on Application of Supported Standing Devices, the Current State of the Literature, which was published in Assistive Technology in 2024. So as we learn more about this work today, I want to really get started with first, Kara, if you don't mind, tell us just a little bit about yourself and your career and kind of the history of what started this project.
Yeah, definitely. Well, first for myself, I am an occupational therapist and I graduated with my bachelor's in 2003. And then I worked in a lot of different settings. Ultimately, that led me to a position at Mary Freebed in the assistive technology department. And the cool thing about that was that we had a really, I think, interdisciplinary opportunity to learn about assistive technology and also then work with clients who really needed it in both an inpatient and outpatient setting. And from there, there were a lot of clinical frustrations, like trying to advocate for patients' equipment on a one-on-one basis and consistently getting the same answers where eventually I got to the point where I was like, maybe there's a better way. And so, or a different way that I could approach this. And I went back for my PhD and started to learn about the systems and how they impact what people can get and how we can better enforce them and maybe create some better guidelines and then the role that research has in that. And so that's what brought me to the Clinician Task Force. And I just really love the CTF and what our aims are. And so with this paper, I had gotten on it, and it started actually in 2019. So this was a long time coming, but it was originated by RESNA to be an update on their original standing wheelchair position paper. And originally, we had 8 total members. It was started by Lori Bernhardt, who was on the CTF board at the time, and Brad DiCiano and David Savage, and then Nicola Bursch, Ashley Dutterbeck, and Jenny Palig, and I were all on this team, and we were talking about this supported standing paper. We decided to expand the original emphasis on wheelchair standing devices to the supported standing devices as total, because there was a benefit. We were thinking about policy implications and thought that for now, this would be a really good way to go, since essentially, or try to understand maybe the different impacts that the different devices have on people who use them, and look at it through that lens. So yeah, that's kind of how I got involved with the CTF and then how this whole paper started.
I love it. Thank you so much, Kara.
Yeah, you kind of introed this already. So with the project being a collaborative effort between the CTF and ResNeb, can you tell us a little bit more about each of the organizations, kind of who they are, what they do?
For sure. So we've been very, very grateful to have a very collaborative relationship with ResNa. ResNa is the Rehabilitation Engineering and Assistive Technology Society of North America. They're a parent organization, I would say, that a lot of clinicians are aware of because they hold the ATP and the SMS credential, which is just showing specialty knowledge in assistive technology, and then also seating and wheel mobility specialist. They also have a national and international, I would say, coverage for all assistive technology products. So it's not just for seating and wheel mobility or CRT, but they address access and education for a variety of people who work in assistive technology and support the individual disciplines and professions, but then also the specific equipment emphasis. And so I appreciate that about them. And then within the scope of what they do, in addition to like their product standards and in addition to their networking opportunities, they also write these position papers and have experts in the fields write position papers on the different topics. And then these position papers are free and they can be used for advocacy for specific pieces of equipment. So like for tilt and recline, for example, there's a position paper for ultra lightweight manual wheelchairs. And this position paper is meant to be along the same lines of that, where it can be used for to advocate for individual equipment and also for best practice when we are looking at supported standing devices. So then the CTF has a smaller focus. We are PTs and OTs across the nation that are experts in complex rehab technology. So the type of equipment, mobility equipment that is used for people who need wheelchairs or some sort of mobility on a continued basis. So we're not talking about people who might temporarily need a wheelchair, but rather people with conditions such as multiple sclerosis or cerebral palsy that often need a mobility equipment to support their everyday life. And these products are more customizable and adaptable for what the individual needs. And that's really important to consider in our clinical process. So the CTF is healthcare providers that are advocating for this equipment. And we both advocate for and educate, I would say, other clinicians who may not work more often or who are interested in this area of practice. So we are smaller than ResNa. We don't have the certification programs, and our primary aims are education and also policy work.
I love it. I am so appreciative, Kara, to both of those organizations. I've been in clinical practice for 13 years, and I have utilized the resources from both of these groups in so many facets, from, you know, program development to just guiding my practices. So such great organizations. So as for the clinicians listening, if you're not familiar, I definitely recommend going to both of those websites just to learn a little bit more about the resources that are available to us as practitioners. So let's dig a little bit into the paper that you guys published this year. The paper is described as a scoping review. So can you explain to us and our listeners as to what that means? And then we'll kind of dig a little bit into kind of the inclusion-exclusion criteria for the paper and what that looked like.
So the ResNa directs the methodology of the paper to an extent, and the board reviews it, and they have a specific public comment process that they require that all position papers go through. But the specific methodology of recruiting the evidence is sometimes left up to the authors, or at least in this point in time it was. And we decided on a scoping review methodology, mostly to make sure that the literature that we were recruiting is systematic in nature, that we had a defined process to including the literature, but also that we wanted to keep the literature search broad enough that we could gather the evidence on the medical nature and functional impact of supported standing devices. With a systematic review, they're a little bit more focused, and I don't want to say limited. I think maybe focused is the best word in nature to the literature that it recruits. Scoping reviews often will allow gray literature, but we did not include that just because of the policy impacts of this paper, that most healthcare insurances, when they're creating coverage policies, do not allow for gray literature to be included. Mm-hmm. So in this case, the systematic or the scoping review was really chosen because we wanted to look at more literature, yet in a systematic manner, and then understand the breadth of knowledge on supported standing devices, try to look at the specific characteristics of the products, and also identify the gaps in the knowledge.
Love it. And what was the group's kind of definition of supported standing? Because there's a lot of different technology out there that all kind of falls into different categories. So what did this group use? And that I would be probably a major inclusion exclusion criteria, right?
Yeah. So we define supported standing as a device that secures a person in a standing position, facilitating movement from a horizontal, like a supine or a prone position, to a standing position, like a tilt table would do, or that moves a person from a sitting position into a standing position, like what a standing frame might do, with mechanical, so like non-powered or electric powered assist. The supported standing device may be separate from a mobility device, which would require a transfer into the device to use, or it could be a system integrated into a person's mobility device, like a power standing system on a power wheelchair. So the definition was quite broad. In the paper, we defined the standing position, device characteristics such as adjustability, supported standing device, and then what a dynamic supported standing device, how we define those. So the standing position is often sometimes something that's under focus because some supported standing devices, often they will allow for a range of positions for the person to stand in, which is very appropriate in the clinical process to try to fit that to the person's needs. And so we tried to address that to an extent as well.
Yeah. And ages and diagnoses included?
Yes, they were. So we included all ages and diagnoses. I think it's really important to look at the literature across the developmental continuum, and also with the understanding that not all adults are going to be at the cognitive level of an adult, and vice versa, you know, that. So trying to understand kind of the holistic perspective on how supported standing impacts the people that we work with was important in this paper. So it was interesting. There were 42 studies that were included in the final review, and we had an equal representation of both pediatric and adult studies. So we had progressive and non-progressive conditions that were represented, although those conditions were pretty different between adults and peds. So the pediatric studies addressed supported standing with cerebral palsy, spina bifida, spinal muscular atrophy, and Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. The adult studies looked more at people with no specific diagnoses or those with limited consciousness, spinal cord injury, stroke, and multiple sclerosis. So we had included all articles for supported standing. We required that they included a person from a population of people with disabilities. So there were no studies included that were solely on typical population of people. And also that the outcomes for the supported standing device alone were reported. So it could have been a comparison against a treadmill device or a stepping device or vibration. But if they had reported that, if they did not report the results for the supported standing device alone, then it wasn't included. So yeah, I think we gathered a breadth of studies on the topic based on this inclusion and exclusion and then the results that we got.
Yeah. Thank you so much. As a reader or as as I'm interpreting or digesting articles, that's the first place I'm always trying to look at, like, what was the inclusion exclusion? So I really understand the content that I'm looking at and the populations that it applies to. So thanks for clearing that up.
It gave us a good basis for seeing patterns across the different devices and across the different ages and that sort of thing.
So, Kira, the paper describes a current synthesis of the articles reviewed, categorizing them into 9 themes based on the ICF model. I love the ICF model. Big fan of it. As a clinician, as an educator, really being able to look and kind of zoom in, zoom out to the different categories, right? Because we want to get really good, important information in each of the categories. But then if we don't do that zoom out and look at the whole picture, you know, we're not gonna see the whole person. We might make inappropriate recommendations if we're not thinking about their environment or their personal factors. So I love looking through the lens of the ICF. Can you talk a little bit about the themes from that were discussed in the paper?
Yeah, for sure. So we found that supported standing changed ICF categories in body functions, activities, and participation in body structures. So for the body functions, the neuromuscular and movement related functions, cardiovascular and respiratory functions, digestion, metabolic and endocrine system, the mental functions and pain outcomes were all categorized. So that was interesting just to see kind of the breadth of outcomes that were represented in the different studies. And then additionally, for activities and participation, we had outcomes in the areas of mobility, self-care, domestic life, general tasks and demands, interpersonal relationships, and communication and learning. So a few studies also addressed supported standing on movement-related structures, like those examining bone health. I wasn't surprised at all to see that the most of the articles focused on body functions and activities and participation, because that's where we as clinicians tend to lie in what we look at. So when discussing the major themes, we first prefaced the discussion a little bit with a few findings. So we found that supported standing systems can impact people across diagnoses, ages, and ambulatory status, and then also that perhaps the use of the supported standing device may be positive both medically and functionally for people with a broad range of standing abilities, from those who find standing difficult for a period of time to those who are unable to stand. And I think often the perception is that supported standing is for people who cannot stand independently, but some of the evidence broadened our understanding in this way. In regards to more specific themes, supported standing devices were found to change joint mobility and overall mobility, digestion, and skin integrity and pressure relief. So joint mobility and overall mobility were definitely represented as the largest outcome areas, but I was pleasantly surprised by the representation of more psychosocial impacts as well, like the impact on personal relationships and the feelings of efficacy and autonomy that can be achieved through supported standing. I would absolutely love to see these outcomes represented in more rigorous study designs in the future as well, because a lot of those studies were qualitative, but I think it sets a good basis for further research. We also found clear patterns in the ways that people use the different types of standing devices and the different outcomes that were achieved by the people who use them, and then dosage was a theme too.
I always find it interesting when looking through the research that's out there. I think clinically for myself, working with a lot of supported standing individuals, the impact on bowel is so huge that we see clinically. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's one of the things that I'm always like, oh, I wish there was more, you know, research available that really supports it, because clinically I'm always like, this is a huge piece for the individuals that I've worked with. So it was fun to get some more information in that area, and hope to see more come forward in the future in that area as well.
I know research is so tricky because there's so many aspects to how it's performed, why it's performed, the funding to perform. So it is. As I've transitioned into this full-time role into complex rehab technology, I've really enjoyed seeing what is available in the literature, but I'm doing my doctorate of health at UIND right now. And as I learn how rigorous research is, there's this gap in between clinical research versus actual lab-based research, and where does complex rehab technology fit, and what study designs are meaningful to give us the information that the end users value, that the clinicians value, and it is I would say
payers more value, than, maybe.
Yeah, payers value. I would say that complex rehab technology is one of the more challenging things to digest. I don't know if you agree with that, Kara.
Yeah, I would say I definitely agree with that. Actually, just in kind of reflecting on the questions for this podcast, that was one of the things that came up, because the evidence on supported standing isn't necessarily as clear cut and dried as we would like. And that's why I think there has been a lot of conflict and questioning on what the impact is. The measuring devices that have been used to measure some of the impact of supporting standing has been different. The length of time that it requires for a person to adjust to a standing position has to be taken into consideration when we look at the results. The dosage that's in the different studies seems to really impact the overall outcomes of the study, but then it also seems like the dosage and the frequency of standing impacts the different body functions differently. And so I think that's something that we're still teasing through and something that is starting to emerge in the evidence, but perhaps we can start to consider it not necessarily as a negative thing on supported standing, but something as, no, we are just trying to understand this really complex task more and complex skill and how it impacts the people we work with even more.
Yes, absolutely. So, Kara, what would you say the overall takeaways from this publication are for our listeners and our audience?
Yeah, I think most globally, it's that supported standing can benefit the medical health and functional participation of people of all ages with progressive and non-progressive diagnosis, and mirroring many studies on ambulatory people, when the person is able, the more they stand, the better the outcomes they're going to achieve. I think we can say fairly confidently that in most cases, supported standing maintains or improves lower extremity joint mobility, sometimes even in the presence of joint contractures. Supporting standing appears to reduce spasm frequency and maintain or improve muscle strength. It appears to reduce discomfort with bowel movements, improve bladder emptying, and it can be considered as exercise for people who may not have as many options to exercise actively. I think, too, like in terms of activities and participation, the standing device that's used is going to impact positively the person's engagement and activity participation as well.
Absolutely. So, Kara, one thing I loved about this publication that your group did, I love the research side, but I really like the clinical application of what context does this research mean to our clinical world that so many of us, you know, as PTs and OTs are looking at. So your group did an amazing job in this paper of discussing both the evidence and the clinical considerations behind that. Could we close out by discussing kind of like what impact do you hope that this paper can have clinically?
Yeah, for sure. Part of it is taking those recommendations from the paper on supporting into clinical practice and kind of considering that there isn't necessarily a clear cut we should do this, but that we need to use our intentional clinical reasoning as we move forward. And so even with that, I think there's a few ways that we hoped that this paper would be clinically meaningful. So in our analysis, we extracted the results of each study in terms of the design, supported standing device that was used, and then also the instrument that was used to measure the outcomes and the significance of the outcome on supported standing. So when considering this clinical application, we felt that these aspects matter a lot because we need to measure the impact of the supported standing on our patient in clinical practice too. And so being able to look at a repository of different measuring devices that were used and then how they were used in the studies on the different body functions hopefully will be really easy for clinicians to make some decisions. You know, an example of this is the evidence that I've seen on supported standing and muscle quality. This is an area where the research isn't as clear, even though anecdotally we hear a lot that supported standing impacts spasticity and muscle spasms. The research supports the impact on spasms, but interestingly, it shows a more scientific impact on strength than on muscle tone. And the evidence-based clinical application of this is that for now, at least, maybe strength and tone should always be measured for people appropriate for a supported standing device. Mm-hmm. But the researchers need to continue to examine muscle quality in perhaps in more objective ways. So like mm-hmm. consistently using dynamometers for strength or measuring resistance to passive movements through EMG activity instead of using the Ashworth scale or the Tardo scale. And this hopefully will help us ensure that we have an accurate picture of the various ways that supported standing impacts this muscle quality in the future.
Yes, absolutely. Muscle tone is one of the trickiest things because the tools we have clinically to quantify it don't represent all of the presentations we see for spasticity. So obviously the modified Ashworth, you know, that velocity dependent, but Dr. Field-Fote out of Shepherd Center did an amazing study on over 1,000 sample size in individuals with spinal cord injury and their perspectives of living with spasticity. And a lot of individuals described stiffness. That was one of the number one. And we don't necessarily have a great way of quantifying that. So it is very hard from a research perspective, from a clinical perspective, to really grab these objective things in ways that are measurable in our current world right now.
Yeah, and so Odine and Knudsen back in 1981 had published a study on, they evaluated the effects of muscle stretch and weight load on patients with spastic paraplegia, and it wasn't included in this review because we only included results from 2000 to 2020. And that was just because it was an update to the existing literature. But they measured this passive resistance to tone using EMG. And it was really interesting the way that they described it. Like, I think that there are methods out there. We just need to do better maybe on that side in the research, even if it's not clinically feasible for the clinical practice right now.
Right.
But yeah, I 100% agree with you on that. I think along with that data and the results that we put in the paper, we also need to consider how the supported standard will relate to the individual's personal context. And the data is clear that the more a person stands, the better it is for them. And that's good for us to know during a person's recovery from acute injury to illness. It also showed that the bone health impacts of supported standing are greater if we start standing earlier after the injury. And so I think we need to consider that as well. But when it comes to recommending devices from this perspective, the main consideration that emerged was the difference between having a standalone versus an integrated standard or supported standing system. And that with standalone devices, we need to consider the practicality of the person storing that device and also like talk about the aesthetics of having that device in a place where the person can access it a lot. I think that like, you know, for all of us, those things matter to us and we need to consider that and have those discussions before we make the final recommendation. And then also write that into our letter of medical necessity or our, you know, our justification for the equipment and try to understand why one device is going to fit in with a person's life better than another. The need for a person to transfer into a standalone device should also be considered. That was noted as a barrier in some of the studies to using it. And then how can we help the person make this an enjoyable activity if they're in a standalone stander over a period of time, right? Because we hope that they're using this for an hour at a time, multiple days a week in order to achieve the maximum benefit. So on the flip side, though, you know, if it's integrated into a person's a mobility device, then we see that people frequently stand more often, that they're able to move from a sitting to a standing position more often. And that relates to your digestive benefits as well, where perhaps the sit and stand motion does help bowel motility a little bit more than just standing for an hour at a time. So understanding how the stander is going to integrate with activities and participation too with an integrated device, we see that people perform more activities all the way from setup through cleanup of an activity. And for adolescents, that's a really important skill that they should be learning. And so being able to understand both the body function impacts and then the activity and participation impacts and putting them in context with our person's needs, I think is something that hopefully this study helped to describe how we can do that in our documentation.
Absolutely. I recently got to present with this brilliant clinician on a CRT topic that we collaborated on, and she said throughout the presentation, which will forever stick with me, and we do it already, but it just, I loved the way she said it, is we have to match the right technology at the right time for the right individual. And that's where us as, you know, PTs and OTs, it's the fun, right, of what we do, of trying to find, there's a lot of barriers and a lot of challenges clinically in that world, but I was like, gosh, that's the best summary in the world of all technology and what we bring for the skill that we offer individuals.
For sure.
Yeah, that's so amazing. I think I have a big global question to kind of round us out. So as we're continuing to wait for CMS, feels like we're waiting and waiting and waiting to open up that public comment period that we're all just ready to go at our endless comments that we're going to put in there. For the power standing piece, I'd love to know your perspective on what this may look like for separate standing equipment down the road, pending a positive outcome that we are going to manifest regarding the current request for the reconsideration.
Yeah, man, Britta, that is a huge question, right? Given their hesitation to even open up the public comment period and open up the NCD request, it makes me wonder if they don't also see this as some sort of waterfall kind of right. topic. I don't think it has to be, and I say that because I think there are ways to limit it to the population of people who are more impacted by being in a prolonged sitting position and who are unable to achieve independently a standing position for a period of time. And I just want to say that because I think it's important as clinicians to take both perspectives. Like, unfortunately, it's probably not feasible for healthcare industry and for insurance companies to cover all the things, you know, like a standing desk would be really great for me too. But also, like, there are accommodations I can make in my daily life to make that happen. And so I think in terms of this and other supported standing devices, I think it's possible. I think it opens the door for those conversations, you know, kind of like with the power seat elevation coverage criteria. We never thought they would cover group two for power seat elevation right off the bat as well. And then they did, and that's awesome. And so maybe they'll see the benefits of supported standing devices for all people who have difficulty standing instead of just those standing systems that are attached to power wheelchairs. The way that the coverage is written and the mobility assistive equipment policies are written right now, it might make it a little bit difficult to make that jump to a standalone standard because we are specifically attaching the coverage criteria mm-hmm. to a power wheelchair that the person has already qualified for through existing coverage. Now, on the other side, I think this scoping review is powerful in that it shows that there are different uses for this equipment and that it is appropriate to recommend one supported standing device for one person's needs and context and another supported standing device for another person's needs. But that those people, when they are in appropriate equipment, may achieve similar benefits. And my hope is that we can continue using that information to advocate to all funding sources for getting access to the right equipment so that when we as clinicians see that a person comes that needs a supporting standing device, we can have a breadth of equipment available to us and we don't have to try to pigeonhole them into this group three wheelchair, you know, or group four wheelchair with a standing system.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Kara, for all of these wonderful conversation that we had today. So we're going to close out the podcast today and discuss just a little bit one more time that if you would like more information on this publication, we will try to attach that publication. It is open access to our show notes, as well as if you have any further questions, you are always welcome to email myself and I'll have my information as well as Britta. And I'm not sure, Kara, if you mind leaving your email. If you have any more specific questions that we can assist with from a complex rehab technology for standing. But we appreciate everyone listening today, and we look forward to hearing having you guys join us for future episodes. But I want to give one more thank you so much, Kara and Britta, both for joining me today with Ultimate Medical.
Thank you.